From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, the Wisconsin Policy Forum finds a nearly intractable situation facing Milwaukee County's parks and cultural institutions.
There is an increasing backlog of repair and replacement needs. The county simply doesn't have the financial capacity to address those on an annual basis, and so the backlog grows.
In the wake of shootings in Wisconsin and Maryland this week, a law enforcement expert discusses some real-world strategies for personal safety.
The human body is amazing. You need to understand that most of the time, if you're shot, you're going to be able to continue to fight through it physically. Now, mentally, being able to overcome the fear and possibly pain is a totally different thing.
A Wisconsin energy company CEO makes a career detour and writes a suspense novel about, well, carbon trading.
And we'll go behind the scenes at the Pabst Mansion with two people involved in maintaining the historic 19th century building.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. We talked a couple months ago about the effort the Milwaukee Public Museum is undertaking to replace its facility and move to a new location. Advocates of the project say both the museum's public space and its offices and archives are largely outdated and inadequate for a modern museum and research facility.
But a report out today from the Wisconsin Policy Forum says there are equally, if not more, pressing needs for many other cultural institutions and parks supported by Milwaukee County, and there is a real struggle to do something about those needs. Rob Henkin is the president of the forum, and he's with us in the studio to share their findings. Nice to have you back here.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
You title this report using a football metaphor, delay of game. Why is that an appropriate title in this case?
Well, in this case, Mitch, as we're taking a look at the condition of Milwaukee County-owned parks and cultural institutions, what we're finding is not that dissimilar from what we found when we took a similar deep dive back in 2013. There is an increasing backlog of repair and replacement needs. The county simply doesn't have the financial capacity to address those on an annual basis, and so the backlog grows, and the game is delayed in terms of getting to the point where these assets are in the condition that I think county leaders themselves and certainly all of the people who use the parks and the cultural institutions would like to see them.
It amazes me that that report was in 2013. It feels like yesterday. But we've talked about these kinds of issues in the past, but remind us just what the kinds of issues that are facing these parks and other cultural institutions are.
Well, it really depends on the institution. So in some cases, we have some very big, large replacement needs. The perfect example is the Milwaukee Public Museum. The facility right now is one that is much larger than any comparable natural history museum throughout the country. There's $30 million of deferred repairs and maintenance backlog. Clearly, in order to survive and to have the type of costs that the museum leadership needs to see on an operational basis, they need a different facility. So in that case, you're looking at, hey, we need to come up with $100 million for a new facility. In other cases, and this is particularly the case for the parks, we have dozens upon dozens of smaller needs, from roofs that need to be repaired to park buildings, from paved assets which have cracks, from parks roadways which need a series of repairs. So there, it's really dozens upon dozens of repair needs that, again, when you total them all up, come to a total that right now appears unaffordable.
The proverbial death by 1,000 paper cuts.
Exactly.
Well, and in the middle of this is another issue, actually, which is that Milwaukee County, and we talked about this, is also in need of a new justice center for many of the same reasons.
Yes. So this is actually the fourth in a series of reports on local government infrastructure that the Wisconsin Policy Forum has conducted. And yes, that's one of the overriding messages here. I think in this case, when you look just at the parks and cultural institutions, you're really staggered by the extent of the need and how that compares with the county's annual financing capacity. But when you go on top of that, and as you say, take a look at other county infrastructure needs, from purchasing new buses to the needs of county trunk highways to, as you just said, the need for a new criminal justice facility that could exceed $300 million, you put all of that together, and it's hard to see how the county digs itself out of this hole.
Right. So, and in the middle of all this is an inability to borrow more?
Yeah, so that's really one of the perverse ironies here, because the county has very responsibly, from a financial perspective, tried to keep a lid on its annual borrowing. And the county has placed some pretty stringent limitations on the amount of bonding that we'll do each year. It's roughly about $40 million per year. The county also has a policy to match that with at least a 20% cash match. What you get out of that is the capacity to finance about $50 million per year of infrastructure improvements. And what we have shown through our research, and this picture really hasn't changed much, is you probably have an annual need of about twice that much. So in the end, the solutions are limited. You can either see that backlog grow, or to the extent at all possible, you can see whether you can liquidate some of those assets or take care of them in some other way other than to make major capital improvements.
Liquidate meaning privatize them or do without them altogether?
Precisely. And I think it's in this particular area. So in buildings, which was our last report, we have seen that the county has been able to relinquish some of its buildings. The 27th and Wells facility is a perfect example. But when it comes to parks and cultural institutions, I don't think anybody wants to see these icons, places like the domes and the public museum and, of course, the Milwaukee County Zoo, as well as all sorts of different parks assets. Very few people want to imagine the day when the county would have to give those up.
You do make the point that some institutions like the zoo are able to raise funds for their improvements in other ways.
Yes. So if there's any good news coming from this report, and there is some, it's that for a few of the major institutions that we explored back in 2013, the picture is actually a little brighter. So the zoo, by virtue of a new capital campaign with a goal of having 50% county financing and 50% zoological society financing, the zoo has been able to make some substantial improvements. Currently, there's a very exciting Africa exhibit that is being renovated and improved for right now for elephants and later for hippos and rhinos. We have seen the Art Museum and the War Memorial. The War Memorial in particular was really on our danger list 5 years ago through a new public-private partnership and other means, a new contract with the county. Some of those big needs have been taken care of. The Marcus Center for Performing Arts is another example of a facility that has been able to count on some substantial private sector support to get needs taken care of. So when you look at those select few, you do see an improving situation. It's with the parks facilities, and it's with some of these lesser-known cultural facilities, such as Charles Alice Villa Terrace, such as the Milwaukee Historical Society buildings. That's where you see some problems.
So you get in a position where there are some haves and have-nots.
Yes, and that's what we are increasingly seeing. And coincidentally, that's a point that we've made in the past with regard to the parks as well, that those parks that have friends groups that are able to generate resources are doing better than those parks where the neighborhood doesn't have the type of financial supporters that they do in some parts of town.
So we talked about the borrowing caps. Are these self-imposed borrowing caps? Is one possibility just increasing the amount that the county can start to take on?
Yes. So while there are statutory debt limits, the county is not yet near those limits. The county has elected to impose this cap. It is self-imposed of, again, approximately $40 million a year that can go up by roughly 3% each year. And the reason the county decided to impose those limits is because of the concern that debt service payments would start to crowd out operational needs from areas not only in the for the parks and cultural institutions, but ranging from the transit system to the mental health complex to disabilities and aging programs, just as examples. And so the downside, if the county were to exceed those caps and borrow more, is that the annual debt service for the next 15 years as the debt is paid off would then crowd out some other operational needs.
One of the easy takeaways from this report is that there are no easy answers to this.
That is clearly one of the takeaways. I think for some of these real big projects, such as the domes, such as a new public museum facility, such as a new criminal courthouse facility, it's going to be essential that the county not have to come up with the financing on its own, whether it's private sector support, whether it's state support. Some additional resources clearly are going to be needed.
Given that you did a similar study like this in 2013, this shouldn't be a wake-up call. This is kind of a need to respond to this news bar.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And in the wake of the research that we did in 2013, there was a special task force formed by the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce. There was a lot of talk about potentially going to voters, and that would require state approval to even go to voters, but going to voters with regard to a special sales tax. I think that's still in the cards potentially. But again, it would need not only local support, but also support from the legislature and governor to allow county policymakers to take that to referendum.
Rob Henkin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. You can find a link to the forum's new report on Milwaukee County's parks and cultural institutions called Delay of Game at WUWM.com.
Coming up, we'll speak with a law enforcement expert about some of the strategies for surviving a mass shooting. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. There have been over 250 active shooter incidents throughout the U.S. since 2010 in schools, places of worship and entertainment, workplaces, and elsewhere.
On Wednesday, a shooter in Middleton injured three people at the software company where he worked before officers fatally shot him.
Matt McGolan is a police officer with the City of Madison Police Department.
He is part of a group of six officers who train citizens on how to respond to active shooter events. He explains to Lake Effect's Mayon Silver that an active shooter situation is a low probability event with a high impact that citizens can do something about.
Just like we don't climb to the top of the tallest tree during a lightning storm, you know, there's some very simple tools you can learn to maximize your chances of survival if you ever do find yourself in one of these circumstances. And so it's really important for people to understand that if you have this toolkit kind of in the back of your mind and you've been trained in it, not only are you going to respond more effectively if the event happens to you, but you're also going to recover more quickly afterwards because it builds in that psychological and emotional resilience that we look for.
And what are the steps that people should relate to if they're faced with an active shooter situation?
So the group of words that we use for this is, I'm sure many people have heard the Department of Homeland Security's run, hide, fight. That's a really common kind of phrase. Now, we use what's called avoid, deny, defend. And we like that better because we don't want just for you to run, you know, kind of mindlessly just run away, because if you're not thinking, then you may get yourself into trouble. So when we use the word avoid, it means avoid the shooter. Because if the shooter never sees you and cannot target you, you cannot become a victim of the shooter. So if you hear shooting, you want to avoid the shooter. You want to go in the opposite direction. You want to break out a window and get out of the building. You want to just move away from the area where the shooting is coming from or where the shooter is, if you know where the shooter is. If you can't get away or avoid the shooter, then basically we say deny access. So create a situation where you're barricaded in a room or an area of a building where the shooter can't get to you, cannot access you. And that way you're basically making it so that the shooter, again, cannot target you. They can't make you a victim. And so we do advocate, as a last resort, we do advocate that you defend yourself. So avoid, deny, defend. Now, this is a shift for a lot of people because most people don't want to use violence in our communities. However, legally, morally, and ethically, if someone is using violence against you, you have a right to defend yourself. And active shooters use kind of the highest level of violence, which is, you know, they're attempting to cause death or great bodily harm. So you have a right to defend yourself and other innocent people using whatever force is necessary to stop that person from doing it. And sometimes, in certain circumstances, it's actually safer to close the distance to the shooter and defend yourself and fight against that shooter than it is to run away from the shooter. Because if you actually run away from certain places, you can potentially put yourself in more danger from the shooter. So it's a little bit of a mental shift for the defend portion of what we advocate, but it's a much more effective. And in about 18% of cases, even before our training, the civilian response to active shooter events training, has become widespread. In about 18% of those events, of all the active shooter events that have gone before, the intended victims actually stop the attack. They subdue the shooter, or we have had incidents where armed citizens have shot and stopped the shooter.
What are some of the tips on defending if you find yourself in that situation?
So basically what we advocate is that you go for the weapon. The weapon is the threat. So about 600 to 1,000 people a year are killed by unarmed people. They're beaten to death with fists and feet. but about 30,000 people a year lose their lives by firearms. So basically, the weapon, the firearm, is a force multiplier for the shooter. So if we can get quickly to that weapon and make it not work anymore or take it away from the shooter, then basically we level the playing field, and now the shooter is not as dominant as they think they are. So what we advocate is that if you're barricaded in a room or if the shooter walks into the room and there's really no other option, you move toward the shooter and you grab over the top of the slide of a handgun with a C grip, and you basically induce a malfunction in the firearm because the slide, the top of the handgun, must cycle in order for the gun to function properly. So if you grab the weapon, you induce that malfunction, you've basically turned it into a big paperweight, because as long as you hold on to that weapon, the shooter can't make it work again. And a majority of shooters use a handgun when they commit their shootings, because handguns are easy to conceal and only revealed when the shooter wants them to be revealed. So I think I believe it's around 77% of shooters use a handgun, a semi-automatic handgun, to commit their shooting. And then once you have a grip on the gun, then we go on the offensive, and we use what's called the hammer fist technique. And that's using kind of that bottom fleshy part of your hand, rather than your knuckles, to strike the shooter. And the target area that we want to attack is the vision and wind specifically. So the nose and the eyes and the mouth. Now, if you've ever been hit in the nose, you know that your eyes water, your eyes close, you move your face away from the injury. There's no way to stop your eyes from watering if you're struck in the nose hard enough. So it creates physiological dysfunction in the shooter. So the key here is to stop the fight as quickly as possible and win. And so that's what's really key is getting a hold of that weapon, leveling the playing field, and then striking back and taking the person out of the fight.
Now, what about if somebody is actually hit by gunfire in a situation like this? How should they respond?
Well, they should keep fighting, because as soon as you give up, you're putting your life in the hands of the person who's already shown they have no respect for human life. If you're struck by gunfire and you arrive at the hospital, no matter how many times you've been shot, if your heart is still beating, you have a 95% chance of survival. The human body is extremely resilient to injury, and the fight or flight response kicks in, which helps our body respond to injury. There was a shooting at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, where the responding lieutenant was shot between 15 and 17 times. He survived because he used what's called autogenic breathing to slow down his heart rate and reduce his blood loss. And he also had kind of a can-do attitude. He basically said, I'm not going to die in this parking lot today. And obviously getting to medical attention quickly was helpful as well, but he survived. The human body is amazing. You need to understand that most of the time if you're shot, you're going to be able to continue to fight through it physically. Now, mentally, being able to overcome the fear and possibly pain is a totally different thing.
And what about the use of a tourniquet?
The tourniquet is one of the best tools to stop bleeding from an extremity. So arms, legs, those areas. And what we do find is that obviously a lot of people are hit in the arms and legs because many times these shooters are shooting just kind of randomly and haphazardly, and they're not really aiming. They're just shooting into larger crowds. And so a tourniquet is a very effective tool at stopping bleeding in extremities. We also train wound packing, which is going to be more in the abdominal areas or the thicker tissue areas of the body. We also train using chest seals, because anytime you have an injury in the chest area of someone, you will likely have a puncture of a lung from penetrating trauma like a firearm injury. And so we train three main types of first aid when it comes to helping with the types of injuries that are found specifically in active shooter events. The tourniquet is just one of the three that we advocate. And then you have chest seals, and you also have wound packing. I just think it's really important to advocate for someone to reach out to your local police department and find out if they offer some type of civilian response to active shooter events training.
Matt Magolin is a police officer with the city of Madison. He also trains civilians on how to respond to active shooter events. He spoke with Mayon Silver.
Coming up, energy company CEO by day, suspense author by night, Paul Schuler explains when he actually does have time to write novels when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Mic Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. Paul Schuler has been interested in energy and environmental issues since he was young and growing up in Port Washington. It makes a lot of sense, then, that he would use those interests in leading Franklin Energy. He founded the company in 1994 with an aim toward helping utility companies be more energy efficient and, at the same time, save customers money.
But Schuler's long interest in energy and environmental issues also informs a little side path his career has gone down. Schuler is the author of a new thriller novel called The Squeeze, which manages to include both murder and carbon trading in its plot. Paul Schuler is with us in the studio now to explain. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. I really appreciate it.
What inspired you to take this turn in your career?
Well, the fact that I'm a CEO of a business has me in a pretty social setting mostly, and I'm not as social as my job is. So I had an opportunity to take some time away from that work setting to do it. I looked at it as a real challenge. I looked at it as an opportunity to do something that I knew would be a failure. And that meant something to me because I'm always on my adult children to try things. And if you fail, that's the way it goes. And I thought this was a good opportunity to show them that.
Where did you think would be the point of failure for you in this?
Well, I think it's a numbers game. You look at it, there's more than 100,000 books in this country written each year. I think there's 1 million to 1.5 million titles available on Amazon. That's a lot of noise. That's a lot of things going on out there. So I expect it to be a commercial failure.
A commercial failure, but there's a certain degree of success that goes with just starting and finishing a novel and having it make sense.
That's the challenge part, and I really did enjoy that. And I'm an engineer by education, so it was a particularly big challenge, I think, for me to do that. And I enjoyed the process. I enjoy writing and really had a lot of fun with it.
As an engineer by trade, is there a certain approach to writing, especially a suspense novel, where there are ins and outs and twists and turns? Do you have a schematic in your mind when you sit down to plot it out?
No, I really didn't. I started with short stories. There were about 3 short stories that started to piece together, and I started writing little scenes in between, and all of a sudden I had 400 handwritten pages of stuff, and then thought, you know, maybe that can be a book. So there was not the...
There's not a blueprint.
Yeah, there wasn't an engineering mind preconceived idea of how this thing would look.
So your protagonist, Tommy Gardner, as he's going through some rough times, makes some offhand references, I think, to writing as an outlet. Has writing always been something that has played a role in your life, even if it hadn't been to this extent?
Yes. Probably 25 years worth of journals and short stories and things like that. I probably have 20 short stories or so that I've written. It's always been my release, always been my hobby, something to do outside of work, and a very private thing for me, certainly. The first draft of the book, my wife and kids didn't know about it till after it was done, so pretty private process for me.
How did you manage to carve away the time without them realizing that you were writing, you know, it's... probably, what, 100,000 words?
It is close to that. It's 90-some thousand words. Good guess,
Thank
Mitch.
You.
That was pretty impressive. It was mostly travel for work and any setting where I was waiting for anything. So a plane, a train, a meeting, I always had a pad of paper with, and I was just in the habit of writing whenever I could. I'm a little bit of a type A, high-stress kind of guy, too, so I'm not very good at waiting. So it really gave me a nice release in those settings.
There must be a certain set of similarities that you have with your protagonist, who is also something of a type A.
Yes. There probably are quite a few things. If somebody knows me and they read the book, there's quite a few things in the Tommy Gardner character. He's a pretty flawed individual. I'm flawed. I'd like to think that I have less of those characteristics than Tommy does.
But he has a lot of baggage.
He's got a lot of baggage. I have some of the same, but not all of it.
Well, and the novel plays out in the carbon trading business, which is, I gather, a world you are somewhat familiar with.
Yes. In fact, one of the reasons for writing the book, too, was a little bit of a release. So 15 years ago, probably, Franklin Energy did some of the review work for the first carbon credits that were traded on the Chicago Climate Exchange. And while doing that, I found out that besides the ones that I approved, my name and my professional engineering license were used to approve others. So there was literally fraudulent carbon credits on the market associated with my name. I didn't do anything wrong, but that always weighed on me. And yeah, that's part of the release, I guess, for doing some of the writing.
Well, yeah. So when you discovered this happened, how did you find out that this fraudulent activity was going on? And this must have been a pretty stressful point in your own career.
It definitely was stressful. It wasn't a lot of dollars, but the whole idea of the fraud happening was troubling to me. And found out through the Chicago Climate Exchange when they were doing follow-up on some of those carbon credits. So very difficult time and something that I didn't know how to handle or manage at the time. And this certainly was a nice release for some of that baggage.
Well, so how does carbon trading actually work? And the review you were just talking about, where does that fall into the equation?
Well, the difference between a carbon commodity market and any other commodity market is it's a little bit strange how you get that first initial piece of paper or electronic offset. So the carbon credit or carbon offset, there's a review process that you go through. It's a lot easier now than it was 15 years ago because it's more tangible. Most of them are associated with power generation. You have a wind turbine or a solar array, and you take credit for the carbon that isn't created because you've used this natural resource to do that. Some of the energy efficiency offsets that we were creating 15 years ago are no longer allowed for some of the reasons that we discovered. But once you have an offset and it trades on a market, it really becomes just like silver or wheat or whatever other commodity there is out there. And then the normal commodity market impacts can happen. One of the things that I really wanted to stress is when there are new commodity markets, there is the potential for disruption and manipulation. And I tried to feature that in the book, too. And I believe at some level, of regulations needed to make sure that we keep our natural greed as a society in check.
And the review that you're talking about is essentially a review to prove that something's actually being done to generate these credits.
Right, exactly. That's why the generation of electricity through solar array or wind turbines a lot easier than the energy efficiency component. So there's probably reasons to not do that at this point, given my history and the history of the industry.
So as the writer in this equation, is there kind of a mental exercise that you go through to say, well, I'm not somebody who would do these unethical or illegal things, but if I were to bend the rules or break them, I wonder how I would do it?
I think like most other things, when you're close to it, you probably know better how to break the rules and how to get by with things. I'm guessing a tax attorney or an accountant might be better at hiding things from a tax standpoint than I would be. So yeah, when you do have some expertise, I think you do have a little bit of insight in how that situation could be manipulated.
We've kind of been talking around this a little bit, and of course it's a suspense thriller, so we don't want to give away too many plot points, but give us at least a brief sense for the events that set the book in motion.
I think the main thing that I was trying to accomplish early in the book was looking at how people got to the point in time they are and what impacted them and their decisions to that point. So for me, it was about friendships that characters had. It was about what happened to them in their hometown setting and how that impacted the way they were going to view the world going forward. So there's a little bit of a two-year flashback at the beginning to kind of set the stage to say, some of those things are going to impact how you view life in the future and how you react to things.
So long story short, you've got Tommy, who is at the start of things, basically taking a deal to try to avoid prison for his role in some, hanky-panky in the carbon trading industry. Is that a fair way to put it?
That is a fair way to put it. So you'd think there were some lessons learned in that process, you would hope, for a character like that. But I think it takes a while to find out if he really learned his lesson or not. And he's put in some situations where he's exposed to settings where he can look at it and say, hey, am I going to do the right thing? Am I going to do the wrong thing? Am I going to try to justify doing the wrong thing for the right reasons? So there's a lot of things going on in that character's head.
Well, and we should note that the book plays out in really two settings. There's a third one a little bit, but the two major settings are Chicago and also an unnamed city, a small town really in Wisconsin, which I am assuming from reading it is based at least somewhat on Port Washington.
That would be a fair assessment, Mitch. It was an unnamed city in the book because I was going to do this under a pen name. So I really didn't want to associate it with Port Washington, and I also wanted there to be a little intrigue associated with that. But again, I referenced earlier that I wanted to take responsibility for this, and I wanted to face my fears, if you will. So Chicago is a great city, an interesting city, and also a commodity trading hub, so that seemed like a good setting for that portion of it. And Port Washington allowed me to talk about the story of how, being raised in a small town can impact you, how friends can impact you, and how that changed things.
Right. And Tommy has kind of two views of a small town like this. One is kind of a stifling place to be escaped from. And as the story goes on, he's exposed to how a town like that means different things to people who have really made their lives there.
Right, exactly. So that town can be a trap or it can be something to be a benefit to and from.
And as someone who does their work in Port Washington, this is probably some thinking that you've had over the years?
It is, definitely. Mitch, this interview is becoming a lot more analysis of me than I expected it to be, but you are hitting on some good points. So yes, I struggled when I got out of high school. It was the last place in the world I wanted to be. And then when I was in my early 30s and we had our first child, I thought, you know what, maybe it's not that bad a place to be. And now we've spent 20-some years there and really have enjoyed it. So it took me moving away from there to understand how that could be beneficial to me, too.
So people might not remember this, but you were a few months ago on our regular business and innovation podcast feature called How Did You Do That?, in which you explained how you did that when it came to building your company. One of the regular aspects of that feature is, basically imparting lessons you've learned along the way. What about in writing this book? What were the lessons that you gleaned either from doing it yourself or you got from other people?
I think I actually made the same mistake in my career that I made in writing this, and that I did a lot of things on my own in my career without a mentor, without really drawing from expertise outside and tried to do it all myself. That was a mistake, and now I kind of repeated that mistake in the writing process. I really didn't do that. I've kidded around with people that have read the book and said that they thought it sounded like a real book, and they were fairly surprised by that. And I'm kind of surprised by that, too, because I tell them that I didn't let a lot of knowledge and understanding of the English language or books get in my way of trying to write. But I've made similar mistakes, I think, in my career or did things that worked out, I guess.
Well, and presumably the short stories you've written and the journals you've written, over your life have taught you something about writing.
Absolutely. I'm a little bit surprised looking back at the short stories that they're a little bit on the dark side. I feel like I'm a pretty optimistic person when it comes to life and how my life's worked out. I'm a pessimistic person when it comes to business because business could always be better. I'm always paranoid about that. And maybe somehow that's shifted over and affected those short stories. But I don't know if they'll ever go anywhere, but they are a little too dark to share at this point.
Not to add another layer of analysis, but I wonder if your writing is the outlet for you to get that dark side of your personality exercised from your who you are.
I think it could be, and again, you seriously have a backup career here, Mitch. If the radio gig doesn't work out, it has worked out well for you over time, but you might want to do a little psychoanalysis for people. Absolutely, very true.
So even if it is not on the New York Times bestseller list, is there a certain satisfaction you get from having this physical thing, you know, like when we were in sixth grade and you did something that you could put up on your refrigerator, this, you know, this physical thing on the console in front of you?
Oh, absolutely. Huge sense of accomplishment. It was a big challenge, as I said. That's why I wanted to do it. It is complicated to try to put that all together, to put 90-some thousand words together, and hopefully it makes some level of sense. And when you have the actual physical hard copy of the book, it is a pretty rewarding experience. I certainly wouldn't mind doing it again sometime in the future if I have the opportunity and if somebody actually reads this one and likes it. I would think I'd want to do it again if I could.
People in your field surprised when they hear that you've written this?
Yes, definitely. It's not intuitive to what I do at all. Again, being an engineer, like we talked about, being the CEO of a 1,200-person business, you know, there's a lot of demands in my time. I also feel that I balance reasonably well with my family obligations, or not obligations, really, the things I want to do with my family and friends. So, yeah, there's a lot of balance there, so I'm proud that a book came out of all of that activity.
You're not selling copies in the lobby of Franklin Energy, though.
I'm not selling copies in the lobby. It was announced at some point along the way that the book was done, and I think there's been a few e-books sold to employees just out of morbid curiosity, so we'll see where that goes.
Well, Paul Schuler, congratulations, and come back and see us.
Wonderful, Mitch. Thank you so much for the time and the analysis. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Paul Schuler is the author of The Squeeze, a thriller that came out over the summer. He's also founder and CEO of Port Washington-based Franklin Energy. You'll find a link to more at WUWM.com.
One more break now, and we'll get an update on things at Milwaukee's Pabst Mansion. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This weekend's Doors Open Milwaukee allows visitors into some remarkable spaces that are not typically open to the public. But there are other remarkable spaces around the city that people can visit year-round. One of those is the Pabst Mansion, one of the examples of the Gilded Age that has stood for more than a century.
Construction on the mansion began in 1890, and after it left the Pabst family, it later became the Milwaukee Archbishop's residence. It's been on the National Register of Historic Places since 1975, and this year marks its 40th anniversary of allowing the public to visit. Pamela Williams-Lime is the new president of the Pabst Mansion, and John Eastberg is executive director.
Lake Effect's Bonnie North sat down with them in Captain Pabst's study on the mansion's first floor. Williams-Lime explained what brought her to the job.
Well, I'd been to the Pabst Mansion many times, and the mansion itself, once you have an opportunity to come in and experience, really draws you back for multiple times. And this opportunity was presented to me to become part of the team to help it continue moving forward and building it into the landscape of the city of Milwaukee, even further than it's come over the past 30 years.
What do you see as some of your biggest challenges starting out as someone who knows the place, you know, somebody who's visited it, but now someone who's really in charge of making sure that it remains here for decades to come?
Sure. I think we've done a really good job, and we're on the path to complete restoration of the home and retaining and gaining more of the original artifacts back to the house. We've collected a number of archives that we've been working on. So the next step is really building a sustainability path for the organization, which will include becoming a bigger resource through lending our archives to other researchers around the country and beyond. And then completing that restoration project, possibly doing a build out to better meet the needs of the community and the activities, be it educational, research, as an organization for the community.
So when you say build out, do you mean literal build out, like adding on into the property somewhere?
Those are considerations being entertained at the moment. What that looks like, we don't know yet. But we do feel that the Pabst Mansion, you know, has a historical presence in the city of Milwaukee. But how we operate and what we offer as a resource to the community is somewhat limited based on the space that the house has to offer.
Now, John, you've been part of this for how long now?
Next month will be 25 years.
So what brought you here?
A flyer.
It was really that simple?
It literally was a flyer at Cardinal Stritch College when I was there my last semester. There was a flyer to volunteer at the Pabst Mansion. Of course, I had an interest in historic architecture, history, and this was just going to be something that was going to get a little job experience.
And here you are.
And here I am.
25 years later. Pamela was talking about the restoration that's continuing, that's ongoing. Have you been in charge of that pretty much along the way?
Pretty much. A real interest of mine was using these original 1897 photographs we have of the house to not only bring the interiors back to what they look like, but actually to start populating the rooms back with original objects. And I think for people who might have seen the Pabst Mansion 10, 15 years ago, even 5 years ago, the Pabst Mansion has completely developed into another institution as far as the aesthetics and the art collection. I mean, I think that's kind of one of the best kept secrets in Milwaukee is the sublime art collection that we have, hundreds of pieces of which actually were collected by the Pabst family. So these are things that left the house in 1907 when they closed up the house and it was sold to the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, have remained with the Pabst family, but over the last 10, 15 years, they have donated hundreds of objects back to us. So they're excited for people to see the house the way their ancestors saw the house, and they're so supportive of it becoming kind of its best self.
Where are the branches of the Pabst family at this point? Are they all around the area or have they gone much farther?
They're all over the world, you know, and there still are a couple of branches that are here in Wisconsin and southeastern Wisconsin. But a lot of the branches over the generations, you know, kind of moved either to California or New England. One branch ended up back in Germany shortly after the turn of the century. So they really are all over the place. And last summer we had the 125th anniversary of the completion of the house and had a all-branch Pabst family reunion. So we had over 80 family members come back to Milwaukee.
Were they impressed?
They were very impressed. They were very impressed with the house. They were very impressed with Milwaukee. We kind of showed them the best of the city, and they could see where the Pabst Mansion fits into that. And I think it's things like that that fuel their interest in seeing the Pabst Mansion continue to thrive, support it, but also to bring original artifacts back. And quite frankly, I think they sometimes challenge one another. Well, I'll give this, but you have to give yours back over as well. And we're putting together a collection of three paintings in the dining room that were separated to three different branches in 1907. We have two of them back in the house, and we're working on the third right now.
So, Pamela, I know you said you've, of course, visited here many years before you assumed your current position. Do you have a favorite place that you like to come back to within the house over and over again?
You know, each time I come back to the house, I look at it with a different pair of eyes. So, you know, the first time you come in, you're just trying to take in the whole house. The second time you come in, you start noticing the details of the structure. The third time you come in, you might focus on strictly the artwork. So every time you come in, you absorb something else and you get more excited about something else. So to answer your question, I don't have a specific favorite room necessarily, but each time I come in, I identify a different detail that really speaks to me.
Again, there's so much to look at, and and I'm sitting facing the door, and I'm assuming this is a closet. The door is gorgeous, but what keeps drawing my eye are the hinges.
The hinges are remarkable, and the store that we're looking at was Captain Pabst's records closet, but also his cigar humidor. So he consumed about $21 worth of cigars a month in the 1890s. That's so we have his cash book, so it's kind of interesting to see what he was spending money on in those days. And that was a lot of money, you know, for cigars. But yeah, this was all done by the Matthews brothers here in Milwaukee. They were like one of the best woodworking firms in the Midwest. It's funny to think of that they bridged this house, and one of their last commissions was Falling Water in Pennsylvania. So it's just very funny to think
very
of.
Different.
Yeah, very different. You know, styles do change. And but, you know, this is an extraordinary house. Again, hard to believe that was built in 2 years.
2 years, and that it almost became a parking lot.
It almost became a parking lot. So it was, you know, West Wisconsin Avenue, then known as Grand Avenue in the 1890s, had about 50 or 60 mansions lining it. And through development, most of those mansions were gone by the 1970s. And when this house came up for sale, really the only person that had the wherewithal to purchase it was the gentleman who owned a hotel next door, and his intention was to tear it down for a parking lot.
So, Pamela, what do you see as some of the first things that you want to accomplish as president?
You know, Milwaukee is such a thriving city, and there's so much energy, and I think that there's great opportunity with partnering with other institutions to make the Pabst more visible for all the resources that we could provide to the community. I think that is a real focal point for the organization as we look forward to generating more support to get some of those other projects done. I think that it really does speak to the history of the city, and we have some huge opportunity with education. You know, developing a relationship with the school systems to become part of the local education and history of the city of Milwaukee. So I'd have to say it is going to be reaching out with to many different partners for a lot of different things as we carve that path for the future.
I also would think that there would be room to keep it on the curriculum for the schools of architecture that are mm-hmm. around. Do you get students in from those schools just seeing what people were doing in the 1890s?
We do on a regular basis with MIAD and with UWM School of Architecture. It's so interesting because this house is really a feast for the eyes when you're used to modern architecture. You know, it is kind of overwhelming in some respects, but it's interesting to see the students really get into the craftsmanship. And a young person in their teens and early 20s, they've never seen kind of these really design dense, rich environments. So it's fun for them to just kind of dissect a panel, a wall, and then they think of how that panel was crafted and you know, it's a detail house. And so I think it, as a learning tool, I think it's just amazing. And I love when we get thank you notes from younger students and what they see here, which is so fascinating because I don't think it's anything the three of us would see, but they see details and they make their own connections. And I know that the Pabst Mansion and the experience they have here will definitely resonate with them going forward.
Well, one of the things that is so key, as you say, for people who are used to a much more, or much less, maybe, is a better way to put it, a type of architecture where things are much more streamlined, there's very little detail, you know, colors aren't like on top of each other necessarily. You walk into one of the rooms and there's so much layering of texture and color and contrast, and you realize that that can all work together too. We're just not used to seeing it
right
now.
And to be fair to the Pabst family and the late Victorians, you know, they were finally starting to understand how to make all of these things work. And I always think this house is that earliest, you know, one of the earliest results of using interior designer and having a son-in-law who was an artist who was put in charge of the interior and making sure that everything harmonized and was cohesive.
Thinking about color.
Yeah, no, and because I think they saw in the 1860s and 70s just how wacky these interiors could get with all their colors and patterns. And this house is definitely, I know to our modern eyes, it doesn't seem like an early 20th century house, but it's definitely moving in a direction. and you can see it. You know, it's the first floor. It's fairly open concept with the pocket doors. It really is a very light, inviting house, including all the wrought iron and antlers that are around. But it's definitely moving into the 20th century. It was a very modern house for its day.
And it is a tool for future design influences. When you look at students coming out of school, you know, what influences their creative design going forward as they pursue their careers going forward. And this is really a great impetus to, you know, having that influence impact what they're going to do in their futures.
Right. Who knows what little piece of something that they see becomes a motif in their own work.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we encourage having students come to us for sort of an interface relationship, whether that's an internship, if they want to volunteer here, or just for touring. There's a lot that can be taken away from the house itself and its design features.
So before I wrap up, I wanted to ask you, John, in the 25 years you've been here, what thing surprised you the most that you discovered about this house or something in this house?
That there's always something more to see about the Pabst Mansion. And that's truth. Because I've always come into this house with fresh eyes. And to Pamela's point, you just do always see something new. And it's extraordinary when you think of coming to the same place essentially almost every working day for 25 years.
I have to say the thing that surprised me the most was the fact that he was a wine drinker more than a beer drinker.
It's our little secret. We won't tell anybody.
Okay. So. No, a secret's safe with us. Yes.
So, he had an interest in a winery in Germany and would bring barrels of wine over here and decant them in his cellar. And he had over 3,400 bottles of German wine laid in at one point.
Wow.
So
none of that's still here.
None of that, unfortunately.
The archdiocese, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not.
They took care of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, those inventory documents have not surfaced yet. So
maybe they will.
Yes.
Maybe they will. Well, I want to thank you both so much for taking a little time out of your day to show me around and also talk to me about the Pabst Mansion. And Pamela, best of luck setting out on your new job. I'm looking forward to seeing what you do.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Bonnie.
John Eastberg is executive director and Pamela Williams-Lime is president of the Pabst Mansion. They spoke with Bonnie North from the mansion, which is located at 20th and Wisconsin on Milwaukee's Near West Side. You can find a link to information about the building and how to visit at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Joy and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Bonnie North, and assistant producer Maddie Andre. We get additional support from digital producer Lauren Sigfusson and our team of specialty reporters.
Susan Bentz, Taryn Powell, Chuck Kornbach, and Emily Files. And we get engineering from Jason Reavy. Michelle Maternowski is the managing editor.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on Listener Support 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.